For 6 weeks, we've been walking through this season called Epiphany, this season of exploring the deepest reality under the surface reality of who Jesus is. On this last Sunday of the season, we have two of the weirdest readings in Scripture. Two readings with esoteric meaning, difficult interpretation, and huge special effects budgets. Elijah on a chariot of fire and Jesus transfigured before Peter, James, and John. What do we do with these readings? Now, the readings are together, I think. I can't read the minds of the lectionary organizers, but the readings, I think, are together because of some thematic and special effects similarities. Elijah stars in one reading and co-stars in the other. But I think Mark makes it clear that the two are very different. Jesus and Elijah are very different. As I said in the introduction to 2 Kings a few minutes ago, Elijah's role in Israel around 875 BC was as kind of a prophet superhero. He's kind of like Batman. He wore a cape, or at least a mantle. He had a metaphorical utility belt full of amazing and magical tools and tricks. He did heroic stuff, big and small. He took care of a starving mother and her child. He defeated the priests of Baal in this amazing and also pyrotechnic God-calling contest. He antagonized the wretched King Ahab and Queen Jezebel. But also like Batman, Elijah's actions were often questionable. He delighted in commanding that the priests of Baal be slaughtered before him. When a group of kids comes out to tease Elijah that he's old and bald, and I'm a little sensitive about this, he conjures up a mama grizzly bear to slice and dice and devour the children. We might think that's overreacting a little. And like Batman, Elijah was strong and brave, and watching out for the weak against the powerful. But like Batman, he had woefully suspect morals and woefully suspect motivation. When Elijah decides to hang up his cape or his mantle, he gives it to Elisha, Robin of sorts, to his Batman, so that Elisha might continue the tradition. Mark, in his gospel, wants us to know that Jesus is operating out of a decidedly different space. Jesus is not Batman. Jesus has only one tool in his utility belt, and that is love. Just love. Because it is the most dangerous and subversive weapon against the powers and principalities of the world. We talked a few weeks ago how love has changed the world in ways that hatred and fear and worldly power cannot. Just in the last 75 years, we've seen how a Gandhi, a king, a Mandela can change the course of nations and of the world with the power of love and forgiveness and grace. And we also know that there are millions, I suspect billions, of anonymous people in a thousand subtle ways are changing the world with love in ways that threats and guns and bombs never can. Worldly power, whether it's political power or military might, is able to enforce certain unwilling behaviors. But only love can transform human hearts. In this strange scene on the mountain, I think Mark purposely differentiates Jesus from Elijah, the superhero prophet, and Moses, the giver of the law. God's voice says, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." Now, I don't know how he said it. Did God say, "Listen to him," which is how I usually say it? But I wonder if God said, "Listen to him." We love Elijah, we love Moses, but it's time to listen to Jesus. Learn from him. Let his life be the model of your life. And that's what we've been trying to do, not very well, for almost 2,000 years. To listen to him, to learn from him, to live like him. Now, we can't do everything Jesus did. Everything Jesus did, he could do because he drank deeply from this unquenchable spring of God's Spirit. But he invites us to drink as well from the same source. You know, I'm wrong there. Jesus does act like Elijah a little bit later in the gospel. Jesus passes on a mantle, not to a designated follower, not to Peter, not to John, not to Paul even, but to all of us. Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart." Learn from me. Interesting how the two words he uses to describe himself here are gentle and lowly. Sometimes it's translated as humble in heart. But it's the same word that we learn in the spiritual fruits that Paul's talking about that gets translated as gentle. We've been exploring for a few weeks about how drinking from that well of God's Spirit yields these spiritual fruit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Today we're going to look at two of that last triad, faithfulness and gentleness, part of the yoke that Jesus lays upon all of us as followers. Now, the first word is faithfulness. The Greek word translated faithfulness is pistis. Now, Greek thinking, or the way the Greeks translate pistis, is the way that we moderns tend to think of faith. Faith is the conviction of the truth of something. It makes me think of a student defending a thesis. But I imagine that Paul, the Pharisee, might have had a different word in mind, which is the Hebrew word enuma. And enuma, which is translated as faithfulness in the Hebrew scriptures, means to support, to confirm, to be faithful, to uphold, and to nourish. That sounds less like a student defending a thesis than it makes me think of a parent doing the small, loving, supportive, everyday, ordinary things necessary for a family to survive and grow and thrive. Faith in the Greek sense makes me think of the big religious acts of the big religious heroes that we think of. We think of the saints for their faith. Being faithful are fed to the lions, and missionaries being faithful are risking their lives in faraway places. But maybe faithfulness in the Hebrew sense is that daily small stuff that the rest of us are called to. The small stuff that makes a life together work. Life together as a family, life together as a community. Guys, I can only speak as a guy because I only am a guy. Guys are great at declaring their faithfulness in the big stuff. I love guy Valentines. I'd climb the highest mountain for you. I'd swim the widest ocean. I'd take a bullet for you. There was a top 40 song a couple years ago. Was I'd fall on a grenade or something?
Bruno Mars.
I take a grenade for you. You know, and I heard that song, I was like, oh yeah, I take a grenade for you. Awesome, that's faithful. And I kept imagining his girlfriend going, yeah, would you do the dishes for me? Yeah, Barb just says, ooh, yeah, thank you. Pistis is landing on a grenade for you, crossing the swirling rivers for you. Enuma, faithfulness, is would you do the dishes for me? Bishop Fulton Sheen wrote a bunch of years ago, our lives, for the most part, are made up of little things, and by these, our character is to be tested. There are very few who have to take a prominent place in the great conflicts of our age. The vast majority dwell in humbler scenes to do humble work. Little duties carefully discharged, little temptations earnestly resisted with strength which God supplies, little sins crucified. These altogether help to form that character which is to be described not as popular or glamorous, but as moral and noble. The small stuff, it's the everyday stuff. We're reading in our Monday Companions class, a book by Shane Claiborne, who is trying to live as a radical disciple, an ordinary radical, as he calls it. And I love him because he doesn't do a lot of analyzing. He's like, I want to do something great for God. I'll occupy an abandoned church. I'll go to India to work with Mother Teresa. And you first think, wow, it's really big, glorious stuff. But when he goes to India to work with Mother Teresa, he's like, hi, I'm here. What do I do? And she says, those towels need to be washed. That's faithfulness. That leper needs his feet cleaned. And this man dying of some unmentionable horrible disease has really nasty toenails. Could you clip those for him? This person needs dignity in the way he dies. That's your job. That's your only job. You're not going to save any of these people. You're not going to fix the situation. You're going to bring dignity and servanthood to these, the least, the last, and the lost. Some of you have read some of Annie Lamott's books. In one of her books, she is talking about how awful she feels after the birth of her son. She's been sick, he's been colicky, she's had no sleep, it's just dreadful, and she's at the absolute end of her psychic rope. And her pastor comes by. And they talk, and the pastor says, what can I do for you? The pastor thinking, prayer. We don't know what the pastor was thinking, but what can I do for you? And she looks at the pastor and says, could you clean my toilet? I haven't been able to do it in weeks. And that is her vision of this pastor being faithful, on their knees, cleaning a toilet. That's faithfulness. Now I'm nervous about when my next home visit with somebody you were going to be. I was like, when I am made benevolent dictator of the world, I'm going to declare that all single moms who have managed to faithfully parent for 18 years without eating their own children will get a medal of commendation for faithfulness. Oh, yes. Okay, dual parents can get one, too. I'm going to be nice about that. And single dads. Huh? Five will work. It'll be fine. Everyone gets a medal if you like Oprah. You get a medal. You get a medal. Everyone gets a medal. Faithfulness comes from having a long-distance vision. You can't parent every day with the small stuff, so aggravating, without having a distant vision for something better and wonderful. Barb and I have a vision for our children. Getting to 18 or 25 without a felony is good. We're all for that. No. But we're not trying to raise a doctor or a physicist or a lawyer or, God forbid, a clergy person. We want to raise a couple of gentle, caring, loving adults who want to leave the world a little better than they found it. And how they do that, we're not sweating a whole lot. I'm Christian because I think that Jesus is the most perfect example of how human beings can go about doing that. I think that Jesus is the perfect window into God's will for us messed up human beings. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. Please be gentle with yourself and with others. Gentleness is a word that's hard to talk about in our culture because it's not valued. It's a slippery word, like love. It sounds like it could be defined as weak, as easily manipulated, as passive. But in the biblical sense, gentleness means that we operate out of a deep confidence in who and whose we are. Gentleness means that when something happens around us, we don't need to react in fear or in anger, which are the two cheapest of human emotions. Emotions that often get sold as its more expensive cousins, bravery and steadfastness. Anger and fear are cheap. Anger says, I retaliate first because I don't feel safe. I'm unsure of myself. Fear says, I fight back so I don't get hurt as a first reaction. Both fear and anger are about protecting oneself and turning the opponent into something that is less than human. A few months ago, there were children crossing our southern border to escape military and gang violence in Honduras. And they were taking a treacherous journey north, many of the girls being raped along the way in order to find safety, relative safety, in the United States. How did we react, or how did some folk react? These are children. Build a wall! Put big guys with big guns all along the border. And we can't do that to children, right? So it's, they're Al-Qaeda. They're Al-Qaeda. They have Ebola. I mean, a news station that shall remain unnamed made both of those claims to make those children less than human beings, so it's okay to do horrible things to them. That's fear. That's anger. And they are the cheapest of human emotions, even though they get peddled because they're easy to sell. Gentleness is the opposite of fear and anger. Gentleness is not needing to react out of fear or anger. It is acting out of the deepest conviction that we, like Jesus, are called beloved children of God. And recognizing that the person who I consider the other is also a beloved child of God. Jesus exhibits such gentleness all the time in his ministry. He can be hard, he can be tough, but he never dehumanizes the other person. He even receives that gentleness from some notable women in the Gospels, a Syrophoenician woman looking for her daughter to be healed, an anonymous woman who comes to bathe his feet with her hair and oil. Gentleness is like an emotional tachometer, or at least it is for me. I realize I'm not in a really good space when my gentleness dial goes down. Usually it goes down first to myself. And I've told you before, I tend toward depression, and sometimes that creeps up and I'm the last to know. But Barb's often the first to know because she'll hear me when I realize I did something wrong or I forgot something or I made a mistake. I'll go, "Oh, you idiot! Oh, stupid!" And I'm really ugly to myself. And Barb's like, "You feeling okay? You doing all right?" And I'm always like, "No." And when I start to feel that way toward myself, I start being that way toward other folk as well. I start getting just as short with other people. I had a conversation with my mom not too long ago, and she said, "You feeling okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, why?" "I've been looking at your Facebook entries for a little while, and you seem kind of angry." I'm like, "No, not particularly." "Well, okay. You're sure you're not depressed?" "Well, maybe. I'll go up my meds. We'll see how it goes." It's a tachometer for all of us. Gentleness means we're not, our being able to be gentle means we have some confidence in who and whose we are. And when that gets lowered, we find ourselves being really short with ourselves and then with another. It's okay for us to... No, I shouldn't say okay. It's normal for us to not feel okay about ourselves. There's a beautiful poem by Mary Oliver. She wrote, "When I am among trees, especially the willows and the honey locust, as equally the beech, the oaks, and the pines, they give off such hints of gladness. I would almost say that they save me and daily. I am so distant from the hope of myself, in which I have goodness and discernment and never hurry through the world, but walk slowly and bow often. Around me, the trees stir in their leaves and call out, 'Stay a while.' The light flows from their branches and they call again. 'It's simple,' they say, 'and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light, and to shine.'" Gentleness is what allows us to shine. Maybe that's a hint of what the Transfiguration's about. Maybe that's where the light comes from. Gentleness with each other and ourselves gives us enough faith and gives God enough room to do, well, the God's jazz we've been talking about. Room enough for God to help make the wrong notes right. I was told a wonderful story by Roger about a jazz singer, Abby Lincoln, who was working on an album called Straight Ahead, and in there she sang a lyrical rendition of Thelonious Monk's Blue Monk, which is just an instrumental piece. The story goes that while she was, and she was having a terrible time with this piece, it was not working out, it was not working out, it was not working out. And the story goes that one day Thelonious Monk stopped by the studio to give his monkish blessing to the project. And he came up to her in the studio and whispered in her ear, "Don't be so perfect. Be gentle on yourself." Those words, she said, were so important for a woman who has never fit comfortably into the expectations often assigned to black women in American society. "Don't be so perfect," which she interpreted as "be gentle on yourself," means that God has space to make the wrong notes right. That's literally God's jazz in the case of Abby Lincoln. But it works that way with all of us as well. Gentleness with ourselves and with each other is what allows each of us to risk and to grow and to challenge and to transform. Faithfulness is the daily discipline to strengthen and develop what God has planted in us. They are the key to our maturation in living like Jesus. They are a key to our own transfiguration. I was so moved by Steve Garnes Holmes' poem this week. As an engineer, as an analyzer, whenever I read a story like the Transfiguration, I keep trying to figure out what's a logical, physics okay way of looking at this reading. Why is Jesus shining bright? Why is Elijah flying up into the sky? What's going on here? It may be that what transfiguration is going on in the eyes of Elisha and in the eyes of Peter and James and John. Maybe enlightenment is not understanding, but seeing the light for the first time. Maybe wisdom is not knowing, but looking. Maybe the whole key to the transfiguration is that up there on the mountain for the first time, the disciples finally could see who Jesus was. Maybe this whole season of Epiphany is about our learning to see what God has really put before us, what God has really placed within us, and maybe learning to hear what God is calling us to do. So on this Transfiguration Sunday, may you be transfigured. May you be transformed to see and to love and to act in gentleness and faithfulness. In Jesus' name, amen.